Hello, you're listening to Boots and Heels.
I'm Becca.
And I'm Lizzie.
Join us as we head across the country, busting some farming myths with some familiar faces.
Oh my goodness, Bex, I can't believe we're almost at the end of series two.
Yeah, it's been absolutely amazing and we've had some really fantastic guests. And indeed, this episode, we've got none other than Nigel Owens. So he's a rugby refereeing legend, farmer, and also president of the National Federation of Young Farmers Clubs.
Yeah, we learned a lot in this one, Bex, especially how to say boots and heels in Welsh. So do keep an eye out for that in this episode. Okay, let's kick straight to it.
Nigel, thank you so much for joining us today. We're on a bit of an episode of Young Farmers and to see your career as a rugby referee and, well, quite a famous rugby referee, really, so we'll be touching on that. So you have had a lot of matches, very well known in the rugby world, but how did your journey into farming start? Kind of, was it after rugby? Was it before? Was there an interest there?
Before, I sort of, but 8 years of age, I think, my first sort of dream was to be a farmer. When I was in school, I wanted to be a vet, but I realised I certainly didn't have the brains to be a vet. So farming was the next best option. So, yeah, a long time before I became a referee. I'm not a farmer's son, not brought up on a farm, although my grandparents had a little small holding. When I was a kid, they had a couple of horses and chickens back then. They used to have a couple of cows that they would milk, and my grandmother would make the cheese and milk and keep the pigs and the chicken to feed the family, because my dad was one of seven. My mum's from a farming background as well, you know, her grandparents. So farming's always been in the background, like most families back then, I mm-hmm. guess. And then I used to help out on a local farm. I worked on a farm when I left school, on a dairy farm. I used to go up to my uncle's farm in Llanon, dairy farm, every school holidays when I was a kid to help out. So it's always been in the blood, and always something I wanted to do. And then started refereeing when I was 16, when I was working on the farm. I was still in school, actually, as well, at the same time. And then refereeing took over then for the next sort of 30 years or so, really. But I always sort of wanted to have a sort of a small holding or something, but realising that, you know, you have to be, either you marry into a farming family, and that wasn't going to happen, or, you know, you win the lottery or something.
Yeah.
But then I managed to sort of save up over the years, and the opportunity came then to buy a bit of land around the house here mm-hmm. A couple of years ago. And that's when it actually all started then. And a small holding came up then. It's pretty much second refusal, really, just 2 miles up the road. So we decided, myself and my partner Barry, we decided to buy that. So what was going to be just a sort of 20 acres here and a couple of sort of 10 or 12 Hereford cattle has now landed up in about 90 acres and a stock of around sort of not far off sort of 60, really. So I'm renting a few fields as well. So yeah, so that's when it all started, really. It's been a goal since I was a kid.
Yeah, I think if you're involved in farming from a young age, and obviously Lizzie, for example, wasn't and then has come into the industry, but farming is something you can't really escape from. It does end up, I mean, it's a very well-worn phrase, but it ends up being in your blood, and there's always a part of you which kind of wants to go back to it or have some involvement in it, I'd say. So
yeah, I think that's true, I think. And you see, you know, a lot of farmers' sons or daughters, you know, sometimes they just don't have any interest, or, you know, they realise how hard work farming is and they go on to do something else, and then the family farm is lost, or and we see quite a bit of that around here. Like the farm I bought now was fourth or fifth generation, but the son became a doctor, moved away, and sort of, you know, when his parents passed away, he was in his late 70s himself, so he wasn't going to come back here, and, you know, the children then weren't sort of from around here, so the farm became available. So you see quite a bit of that happening, really. So yeah, so it's in your blood, I think, particularly because it is a way of life. It's a very enjoyable way of life, but also can be a very hard way of life as well, in so many ways, really. So you know, as I said, I was fortunate to save up, and it needed some saving up, because I had to start from scratch. You know, I had to buy the land, put the sheds up, buy the cattle, buy all the machinery. So I started from nothing, really, where, you know, other farmers' sons and daughters usually sort of, you know, take over the farm. So everything is there. So, Yeah, but it's, you know, something I'm very passionate about. Mm. And as you say, it's a way of life as well.
Yeah, I think some of our listeners will probably, well, kind of resonate with that story and find it probably quite inspiring, the fact that you can start from nothing.
Yeah.
And you can build up, you know, look after your money right, look for the right areas, mm. and yeah, be able to make something out of nothing, which people, yeah, mm. an inspiring story, really.
Definitely. So how does it compare then to being out on the field in front of thousands and thousands of fans, to then kind of being in the middle of the night, freezing cold, coughing a cab?
When you're out in that field, those thousands and thousands in the stadium are not your fans. They're always booing you as a referee. So when you're out in the cows in the field, they don't boo you. They moo you, they don't boo you.
I love that.
So, I suppose it's very similar in a way, and I suppose very sad in a way, if you look at it from this perspective. It can be quite a lonely place, because mm. when you're on the field as a referee, you're on your own.
Yeah.
You have a team of officials assisting you, but you're basically on your field, on your own, doing those decisions. And when you travel, you know, if I went to New Zealand, something like 14, 15 times to referee. And if you went to New Zealand, you were there for maybe 3 or 4 weeks, and a lot of that time, you were on your own. Now, I had some friends out there, you made friends out yeah. there. And sometimes your assistant referees be with you. Sometimes if they'd come from Australia, for example, they'd fly in on Friday, do the game with you on a Saturday and fly home, and then come back the following week. So you spend a lot of time on your own, particularly yeah. in different parts of the world, you know, away from your family and friends. And farming as well can be like that. You know, you spend a lot of time on your own, particularly in yeah. some areas that are quite remote. You know, it's just the family, just you on the farm. So it's very similar in that way. And I wouldn't say that I like being on my own, but I'm used to being on my own for refereeing, so I don't mind it. Now, I prefer company. I like seeing people call and mm-hmm. people come to the farm. Your family and friends are around you here, which is great. But, you know, when I have to be on my own on the farm, I'm used to doing it, really. And I think it's important, I think, you know, that people who do feel isolated or feel alone, that there is somewhere they can go to yeah. speak to somebody, or, you know, to keep in touch with people, whether it by phone, by Zoom, or, you know, go and people call to see them, or, you know, they go to the market and see people. Like, I think that's very, very important. But the similarities to refereeing sometimes are quite similar, really, you know, particularly when it comes to mm-hmm. to working alone, because, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, you know, you wouldn't be working on the farm on your own. You'd have your family working with you, your yeah. brother, your sisters, or, you know, people working. Now, today, you know, for the viability of it and cost, and if you want to make it work, sometimes you have to do a lot of the work on your own as well. So, yeah, it can be quite a lonely place. But I think it's important then that you make sure that you do sort of, you know, see people and speak to people. And it's nice when people call to see you.
Yeah, it's crucial that you say that, because I think recently in years from our discussions, it's been so apparent how isolating farming can be, you know, how it can affect things like mental well-being. And I think the fact that we've had a pandemic, a lot of people outside of the industry can now really understand that,
mm.
to understand what it's like to not be able to, you know, see people for however long, and you're just kind of at home, and in your home and work life balance is, yeah. is pretty much joint. So mm. yeah, I think it's crucial that you've mentioned that.
Especially in some you know, some farms and really some remote yeah. places, you know, there's nobody mm. around. And when I'm in Pontypridd here, you know, as you've seen, the house here is at the bottom, at the end of the street, and then the sheds are there and the fields are around. Now the farm is a couple of miles up the road, and it's a little bit, it's not remote, you know, there are farms around you, but it's, you know, you're in the middle of the village here as well, which is quite unique in one sense. So you always see people, you know, when you go out and yeah. out and about as well, which is important.
Mm, I think that work-life balance thing is really important, because as a farmer, you don't really switch off, because you can't. And as you say, when the cows are literally on the doorstep, you know, you can't resist, oh, best just go and check them again, mm. or, oh, no, I couldn't possibly leave to go and do something because one might calve. And actually,
well, that's when the CCTV cameras yeah, come in very handy.
Yeah, ideal. Yeah, you can save that rainy trip out. But I think people working from home on laptops, there's a big blurred line, and oh yes, I finish at 5. Oh, but I could just work another couple of hours. And then I think that has probably, people have found more of a kind of alignment with farmers who don't switch off, mm. And hopefully maybe have a bit of an empathy towards kind of the way of life that you have to do as a farmer. But on the rugby field, you are known for some very witty one-liners. I mean, there are a lot of compilations out there if you want a bit of a laugh. But what would you say your funniest moment has been on the farm? Do you have any kind of, well, farm bloopers? I mean, me and Lizzie have had
We've got plenty.
God, yeah, there's been a few. When I worked in the Wern farm in Drevach, we were I was trying to get one of the young calves because Howard, the farmer, he wasn't doing anything, putting collars and calves and stuff. Neville, his son, does now and shows quite a bit and stuff and quite successful at it. So I sort of started putting a collar on a young calf there, and obviously the calf was a little bit stronger than I was, and I put the collar on him, and the next thing, I'm just running down the yard with me sort of being dragged behind him. There's no way I was letting go. So yeah, no, there's been a few moments, you know, over the years, yeah, certainly. But there has been.
There's never a dull moment in farming, is there?
No, definitely not.
So this is a bit controversial, I think, but where I have moved to, back in Yorkshire, there are huge rugby league fans. So I now get involved with rugby more than I ever have. So I go to kind of rugby league games with Cass Tigers. I'm going to blame my boyfriend for that one. So what was it for you then that drew you to rugby union rather than rugby league?
Where we live, I guess, because, yeah, you know, rugby league is sort of traditionally sort of north.
Yeah.
And you know, in Wales, rugby union is the game. And when you're growing up as a kid in Wales, you know that's all you do. Particularly back then, in most of the schools back then, there wasn't football. You know, it was just rugby. It was rugby, and then athletics in the summer. So it's a way of life as well. You know, it's a religion in one sense in Wales. So, yeah. And then you did see the odd sort of rugby league, a rugby union player then go north to rugby league, and particularly during the sort of mid to late 80s, early 90s, you know, the likes of Scott Gibbs, yeah, Jonathan Davis, Devereux, Roland Phillips, Di Young, you know, a lot of big Welsh names, you know, massive players went north. It was quite a huge exodus in that sort of mid to late 80s, really. And Wales then started doing really well in rugby league because, you know, some of the best players are playing rugby league then. Yeah. And then rugby league became quite popular then here. You know, we played it in school, dinner time and stuff, because your heroes were now playing rugby league. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was on BBC as well back then. So, you know, as a kid you'd watch it, and then I think it went then to behind a paywall, then it went to Sky, I think. Mm-hmm. It went, and then, so, you know, you wouldn't see it on telly as much. And then when rugby turned professional then, the sort of stars started coming back then, and sort of your Jason Robinsons and a few of your big names in rugby league then turned to rugby union. The tide shifted, really, and it lost its popularity then here. You know, it's still, you know, I still enjoy watching rugby league, but it's certainly not what it was back in the 80s here. And if you're in Wales now, rugby union would be your first go-to, really. The odd one goes to play rugby league, but very, very few and far between now. So, yeah, but I enjoy watching rugby league, but no, I'm a rugby union man. But, you know, rugby league's a great sport as well. And, you know, it's come from rugby union when that split happened, you know, a long time ago, around the dispute around players being paid or not, and that's when the split happened. So it's very, very similar, isn't it, really, in one sense. Yeah,
it's, but definitely it's something I think as a sport as well, you can, as a spectator, I feel like you can really get involved. You almost feel like you're part of kind of like a family.
Mm.
And, you know, I just love going to rugby league games and kind of like getting my Cass Tiger like prints on, and, you know, it's just something you can get really involved
with. Yeah, and it's the same here in Wales, particularly when Wales and stuff play, like, you know, it's It's something special.
Yeah.
So in your refereeing career, would you say, I mean, probably too many to say, but is there something that stands out or a highlight from your time refereeing?
Yeah, there's quite a few different highlights for various different reasons. When you do your first sort of European Cup final, your first European big match, your first live match, your first Six Nations, your first international, but the one that obviously stands out would be the World Cup final, you know, back in 2015 between Australia and New Zealand in Twickenham, which was something special. And what made it special was quite a few different reasons, really. You see so often in cup finals, whether it be domestic in rugby league, rugby union, internationals, World Cups, is it so often disappoints a final. The pressure on winning, you've done all the hard work and now it's down to two teams and somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. So the pressure then often stifles, you know, the game as a spectacle. Mm-hmm. But in the World Cup in 2015, many different contributing factors. The weather was great, which is something very rare for that time, September, October, and sort of last week of October. And the teams played brilliant rugby, so it was very enjoyable. You know, it was a hugely exciting World Cup. Now, in the World Cup in Japan in 2019, although I enjoyed it very much, the standard of sort of matches were very, very few and far between of excitement and good quality. So in 2015, the World Cup was really special. And the fact then that, you know, I got appointed to the final, what it meant for my family and the village of Manukerig and my dad, you know, they had bunting out, they had posters up, you know, it was like a carnival week there all week. The club was open every day and every night. It was, it was one huge party all week and the following week as well when I got back. So that made it more special as well, like, you know, just pulled everybody, the community just all pulled together. There were people travelling from, you know, hundreds of miles away just to come and see, you know, where I was from, you know, and see the bunting up and the posters and go to the club and stuff where I was, you know, going to and stuff like that. So, it was something very, very special. So that will stand out, really. And as I said, you know, I was fortunate it was a great Rugby World Cup and the final proved to be, well, at the moment, the best World Cup final that's been as well. So to be a part of that was something something really, really special, really. So, yeah, that's the standout moment, without a doubt.
Yeah, amazing. Fantastic. So moving on then to kind of back to farming. You're president of the National Federation of Young Farmers Club. Mm. So for people like me who are from a farming background, what is Young Farmers and can people get involved if they're not from a farming background? How would they even go about that?
Yeah, you certainly can. Because I wasn't from a farming background, although I was sort of, you know, helping out my uncle's farm. I wasn't sort of a farmer's son or daughter, as I said. And me and my cousin, Helen from Manukerig, and she wasn't from a farming background and not really that interested in farming, to be honest. We sort of was asked by the club leader, Howard, the farmers, to work on if we'd, you know, Llanarthing Farmers Club was struggling a bit. The numbers had gone down, and then Howard and Delith, ex-members, took over the club leadership. Mm-hmm. And then sort of, you know, asked us, because we used to sort of go to chapel and, you know, perform in chapel and stuff like that. And we sort of known within sort of that circle if we'd like to go. And we went to the Young Farmers Club, and they put a minibus on then to pick us up, because Llanarthe Young Farmers Club was about sort of 5 miles away.
Yeah.
4 or 5 miles away. So a minibus came then every Tuesday night to pick us up. And then all of a sudden, 10, 12, 14, 16 of us were going then. So the young farmers grew, and a lot of the young farmers in Llanarthe back then, probably I would say at least half of them were not from a farming background. And we became hugely successful in competing in public speaking. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do so good in the sort of agricultural side of things. You know, we did very well in the Eisteddfod and things like that. And it was, so a lot of non-farming young members became part of Llanarthe then. So, and, you know, enjoyed the experience. And they were sort of not just, you know, learning the different skills of public speaking, you know, having things on in the club or going to visit stuff.
Yeah.
They also then were learning a little bit about the countryside and about agriculture as well, which was important because at the end of the day, it is a young farmers movement. Yeah. So it is, and I would, you know, say it's definitely one of the best movements there, because the opportunity it gives you, you know, to try all of it, even if you're not from a farming background, there's a lot of things you can do, you know, if you're not interested in the agricultural side of things. Mm-hmm. So it is, I think, one of the great movements, and very enjoyable movement as well. And I owe a lot to it, particularly from sort of public speaking side of things and performing and acting in the nativity plays, you know, the pantomime competition every year is a great fun. You make friends for life. And it is a very, very special movement. So I would encourage anybody, you know, to go, even if you're not from a farming background, but also as well respect the farming background and, you know, mm-hmm. try and learn a little bit about the farming and agricultural community as well, because it is, you know, even though if you're living in, you know, I was living in a council estate in, mm-hmm. in Mynydd Cyrig, so even if you're not living on a farm or in the countryside, you know, you there'll be a countryside, and farming touches everybody's lives every day. You know, whether you eat meat or not, whatever you eat will come from farmers. And I don't think some people realize that. So, you know, I think it is definitely a great movement, and I owe a lot to it and the opportunities I had. And that's when I was asked if I would be president of the Wales Young Farmers then, which I did for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I was sort of had the privilege then of being nominated to become National Young Farmers member, which I'm, you know, doing my second year. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. COVID has struck and I haven't been able to go around and visit. So there's one or two things that I'm hoping to go to now in the next few months or this year. You know, so my sort of hands-on involvement has been very little, unfortunately, but hopefully, you know, that I'm able to sort of spread the word about the great movement in every opportunity I get.
Definitely. I think it's a really important point to mention, albeit, you know, it's a youth organisation. I mean, quite a lengthy age group, really, from 10 to 28. So actually, you know, you're 28 and you can still go to things and obviously beyond as well. But I don't think you can underestimate the long-term benefits. As you say, you mentioned public speaking and, you know, friends for life. And I know my parents are still friends with people from their young
And it
farmers.
Grows you as not just in individual skills. I think it helps grow you as a person, you know, and contributes to your values, your moral compass and stuff as well. Mm. Because particularly with the influence you have around you with, you know, if you're a young kid going there at 13, 14 years of age to the Young Farmers Club and you have somebody then who's 26, 27, you know, their encouragement, their words of wisdom, mm-hmm. you know, things that they've experienced growing up, which they can pass on to you, the good and the bad. So it really is, you know, when you sort of grow up and just a group of friends the same age, you know, I think you lose out on a lot of things, because then when you're part of the Young Farmers family, you know, you'll be participating in things where somebody will be 28, you'll be 12. And there's that friendship, that camaraderie, that learning from people who are older than you learning from younger people as well. And I think it contributes hugely then to growing you as a person as well. Yeah. Very similar, again, to the rugby community, you know, the values that rugby teach you. You know, the value of respect, being part of a team environment, also being able to, you know, have your own role in the team as an individual, but the bigger picture, you're part of the team, very similar to the Young Farmers Movement. And there is a huge connection between rugby and farming, you know, from a lot of farming backgrounds are rugby players and vice versa. And obviously, I think those value of respect as well, you know, integrate between the two as well.
Definitely. So Young Farmers has been established for, 90 years. What do you think, you know, we need to do as young farmers, or kind of wider? What do we need to do to make sure that it's still here and kind of as strong in 90 years? Because I do hear of clubs kind of around us and even beyond, you know, they've struggled to come out of COVID. They've really struggled on members. I mean, I'm personally very lucky to be in a currently very strong club, but there's some clubs which are struggling, and I think sometimes the kind of makeup of Young Farmers might be changing a bit, as opposed to lots of individual clubs in a small area. We might be moving to streamlining it a bit and some merging. But what can we do for it to be?
First of all, I wouldn't be too worried about that, because I think that's the way society changes. If you go back 20, 30 years ago in this village here in Pontyberem, you'd have five or six, seven pubs or clubs. If you look at many pubs and clubs close now, you know, they streamline them. Look at many football clubs there were in little villages years ago, and now they've become less. Or in the rugby term, you know, some clubs will go, a new club will start. And that involves, I think, and the same with the Young Farmers clubs as well. I think the key thing is what we need to do is what we probably haven't been doing very well is showcasing how much of a great movement it is, and encouraging people who may not be a farmer's son or daughter to become part of that
community. Well, I'd never heard of
farmers. And that's what we haven't done very well. Now you've got social media now, and I think this is a tendency, really, I think, in a lot of areas within our societies is, you know, people, you know, they say empty vessels make the most noise, you know, when you have a minority of people shouting loud about things and running down the agricultural community and the farming community, you know, we then as a farming community should be showing our voice a bit more. So, well, hang on now, you know, this is what farmers do. Look how much farmers contribute to keeping the countryside tidy, you know, looking after the wildlife, looking after the hedges, and, you know, planting trees in some areas of the farms, you know. I've just sort of double fenced some fields up the farm now and planted probably about, not far off, about, I would say, about 1600 meters of new hedges where there wasn't hedges there before. So, you know, I think that's something we need to showcase more, and I think farming needs to change, and farmers need to involve as well, but we certainly do need to show the things that we do very well, you know. And also, you know, there's no doubt that the farming community, for example, it needs to move on as far as we are with the environment and, you know, the climate change. We need to be part of that and contribute to that and learn from things we haven't done well and things we can do better, as well as all other industries and everybody, you know. It's just single households who would never recycle 10 years ago. Now people are recycling, and it's the same. So we need to move on. There are things we can involve and do better, and we need to showcase what we are doing in changing that. And I think it's the same with the Young Farmers Clubs. I think, you know, we need to embrace that change. I don't think you want to go away from your roots, because the backbone of what your young farmers community and club is, and your farming community, should always be there. And you don't want to lose that. But also as well, the things that you can improve on, can do better, change the way we do things, you know. And, you know, if people are struggling with COVID at the moment, you know, we should encourage people, like, you know, on Zoom to still keep meeting, discussing, chatting together to keep their interest there. And hopefully then, you know, when things get back to a bit of normality, we're able to go back into the club environment as well.
Going back to what you were saying there about COVID and keeping connected, I think a lot of people tend to use rugby as an escape, maybe from the farm, to kind of connect with people away from their job and home. Do you think sport is really important to mental well-being? Encouraging that.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's a role reverse as well now, because, you know, sports people have become professionals now. It's your job. So it's important then that you have something else to do as well from that. So whereas years ago, particularly from rugby, it wasn't in rugby union, it wasn't a job. So, you know, it was a hobby. Well, now, same as me as a referee, it became my job. So then I needed another hobby. And my hobby was, you know, doing little things on helping out on the farm in Wern in Dravach, and, you know, doing stuff, you know, at home here. So it is, I think, it's important, I think, whatever job you do, that you have something outside of that and get a good work-life balance. Now, yes, farming, very different to most other industries, requires sometimes 24 hours, you know, if you're calving or lambing. Then you need to, you know, be aware that you may have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. So it is a 24-hour day sometimes, and you need to find some rest within that. So getting a balance, you know, and when there are times then that you can go and participate in different activities, go to farmers clubs, go to a rugby match, whether it be a player, a spectator. And I think that is important in all walks of life, and even more so in farming, because you can be tied at home for a huge amount of time, and it's important that you're able to switch off and go and do something then when time allows for your mental and health and well-being as well. And many negatives that COVID has brought, it has brought some positives as well. It's made people realise that there are some things in life that are more important. It's also made people realise how important the community is. It's also made people realise when the shelves are empty in the shops, there's no food in it, where that food comes from, and the hard work the farmers put in, and bring in that food to the showers, whether it be meat, veg, or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. But I think as well, it's shown that you can get a good work-life balance. You know, I think now, and this will be important, I think, going forward, where, you know, people who've got a young family at home, struggling to pay for childcare, you know, picking the kids up from school, the worrying about being able to do that because you're working, you have to work to pay the mortgage and pay the bills. But now people have realised, well, hang on, you know, I can work at home a couple of hours or a couple of days a week, go into the office in another couple of days, so you have a perfect balance there, and I'm able to save on childcare for 2 or 3 days. It is. And and I think it's important that it doesn't go from one extreme to the other. It's important that we don't sort of stay at home 5 days a week and work and not... I think it's important you go to the workplace, that you do see your work colleagues and interact as well, because you can pick up bad habits by being at home all the time. So if you can get that work balance right, which I think a lot of companies will be doing now, you can work home a couple of days a week and then you go in the office a couple of days a week, and that is a good work balance. And I think that's important with farming, even more so now that you get that good work-life balance, I think. You have to. Yeah, there'll be times of the year when you are going to be, you know, particularly doing harvest or lambing or your calving block, you're going to be pretty much, you know, for a few weeks, it's just going to be hands-on 24 hours a day, really. But then when that period is over, it's important that, you know, and now I'm back training, back playing rugby or whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something you definitely understand, isn't it, Bex? Mm-hmm. The
definitely
kind of periods where you're like, I've got to harvest, you know, it's going to be a really tough few weeks.
Yeah, and you're tired. And actually, for me, I work on the family farm. So it adds another element when it's even harder to say no to your family at times. You know, you don't have anything like set hours. You don't have, you know, even really set jobs. You just do whatever comes your way.
Yeah.
And you don't want to let anyone down. So.
And that was very similar to the refereeing again, because refereeing wasn't a set job. You know, you had to travel. So games could be on a Thursday night or a Friday night, a Saturday afternoon, a Sunday afternoon. So. Yeah. You know, some weekends you'd be travelling on a Friday, game Saturday, not home till late Sunday night. So your weekends were pretty much, you know, all tied up, really.
Yeah.
And you had to be very flexible. You know, sometimes if there's a midweek game on a Wednesday, you'd get a call, you know, so you need to fly tomorrow. Or I remember I was out speaking in Singapore and I was due to fly back on the Sunday or the Monday. And got a phone call, look, you need to fly to Australia for 3 weeks. A referee's been injured. You need to go out there and referee. So then it's a case of somebody getting my bag up to Heathrow, putting on a flight for me, and then me picking it up then when I got to Australia.
I was just thinking about the packing. I was like, does that mean you have to go everywhere with like a bag for every country?
Well, no, I had somebody at home here to go and, you know, tell them, look, shove this, shove that in, and then send the bag up to Heathrow. And so, you know, it's very similar in that sense as well. My weekends used to be sort of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, really. But then when you're at home, everybody else is in work. And then when you're in work, everybody else at home. So it's very similar, really, to, you know, to life on the farm in that sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Where's the best place you've been?
Oh, it's a very difficult question. You know, I still love going to sort of some of the places in France, south of France. To love going out to Ireland to referee, you know, or drive up to Bath, referee in the Rec, and, you know, and stay there, then come back the following day, or New Zealand, you know, was pretty unique. Australia then was very different, but equally enjoyable. So South Africa, I love South Africa. Of quite a few negative points there, you know, between crime and safety and stuff like that. But then sort of, you know, the rugby, the passion, the different cultures, you know, so much difference to do there. It's such a great country. It's just such a shame that, you know, it needs to sort of, you know, try and stabilise things and get out of that sort of circle of crime and murder and stuff that gets on there. It gets on in every country in the world as well. But, you know, in South Africa, particularly the last few years, particularly since the passing of Nelson Mandela, like, you know, they really have been struggling, you know, with corruption and everything like that. So, but, you know, that's the same in a lot of countries, to be fair. But it is a very special, special country, South Africa is. I did enjoy South Africa, particularly in Cape Town. So that would be one of my favourites would be Cape Town, I think, in South Africa would be pretty special.
Wow. Maybe we should do Boots and Heels on tour to South Africa.
Yeah, do you fancy a tour across the country? We should do that. Across the country, across the world. You know what I'm saying. So, something Becca and I have been kind of touching on in other episodes is this kind of idea of diversity. And there's often an undeniable parallel between farming and the sporting world, that there is often these kind of stigmatized perceptions about sexuality, and it's not where it should be. I feel like we should be further on than that. What are your experiences having been in both industries?
I think it's a lot to do with that sort of macho image, yeah. I guess, particularly in men, because, you know, suicide is the biggest killer of men in the UK between up to the age between the teenage and the age of 40, I believe. And there is that sort of macho image, particularly in the construction industry, in rugby, in the farming community. Yeah. You know, you're the man of the house. You know, you can't show any sort of weakness, because you feel that showing your feelings or emotion is a weakness, or actually it's not. It's actually a great strength, and yeah. You carry that burden. Sometimes you don't share it. So that, I think, then subconsciously contributes then, I think, to, you know, moving on as far as diversity and inclusion and equality mm-hmm. goes in, you know, in the farming industry between husband and wife to start off with, you know, let alone different sexualities. So, but, you know, the positives within the rugby community and the farming community outweigh the negatives by a long way from my own experience. I'm pretty sure, you know, in all walks of life, there are people who are struggling with accepting people who are different to them or what the norm is perceived to be. But I think, you know, as time changes, generations change, educating people understanding that, you know, even though the person you may fall in love with will be different to the person that they fall in love with. But at the end of the day, you're still a human being. So getting people to appreciate and understand that and respect, mm-hmm. I think, is important. And hopefully, you know, that will change as time goes on. It certainly has changed, but I think there's a lot of work to do again. And, you know, if you look at some farming communities, or some farms, or some farmers, you know, with when the female vet turns up on the yard, oh, you know, no, I don't want a female vet. Or, you know, when the female vet turns up the first time, it's, oh no, hang on, I don't want a female. So, mm-hmm. you know, that is something that still goes on.
Yeah,
although that barrier is being broken down, you know, and the vet we have here, Sarah Jane, she's absolutely brilliant, you know, as well as a husband, Reese, who comes here occasionally when she can't. So, you know, so there's a lot of barriers to be broken down as well, and I think, you know, that comes with time, you know, and generation changes and educating. And I think, you know, when we talk about parents' influences on their children growing up, where the influence on children on their parents then in diversity and inclusion plays an equally important part as well.
It's something we're passionate about, isn't it?
I think with your comment about the vet, that's really interesting, because the first time they turn up, oh gosh, you know, and they will sometimes get that response, but probably they'll do an absolute cracking job.
Yeah.
This farmer will call up, oh, you know, I've got a cow which needs a cesarean. Oh, you wouldn't send that that lady vet we had last time, would you? She was very good.
And
it doesn't take much. They'll do as good a job. Sometimes, you know, people who just have different strengths in different areas, they'll do as good a job as anyone, and they'll be asked for next time.
Exactly. And it's, I think as well, it's, you also sometimes have to sort of understand where the older generation have come from.
Yeah.
You know, growing up in the sort of 40s, 50s, 60s, things are very different to what they are today. Mm-hmm. So their outlook on life, the language that they're using, you know, you know, the thought of a woman vet or a gay person on the farm 50 years ago, you know, was something, oh, no, you know, that would never happen.
Yeah.
You go back, you know, even 10, 20 years ago, some workingmen's clubs, some golf clubs, you know, no women allowed in. Mm. So, you know, So you have to understand as well how things were different. Doesn't make it right, but things were different back then, and how maybe it's difficult for those in that older generation to understand this change. Yeah. So you need to also sort of, you know, bring them with you and try to get them to understand, well, look, yeah, no, things are very different from 40, 50 years ago to what they are today. You go back centuries ago, they were, you know, putting people on a cross and burning them because they were different religions centuries ago, you know. So things evolve, things change. And so sometimes you have to bring that change. You need to understand, you know, how they are finding it difficult to understand that change and help them understand and bring them with you as well. Because the biggest danger, I think, is extremism, whether it be to the right or to the left. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest, you know, whether you're, if, let's say, for example, look, I have some friends who are vegan and that's their choice, but they don't tell me what I should eat.
Yeah.
But then you come to extreme veganism then, who sort of, you know, try and go and vandalise a butcher shop, or we walk into restaurants and try to, you know, strip people who are eating their meat on the plate, and that's extremism, you know. And that is dangerous, whether it, and the opposite side as well. Yeah. So it's actually respecting people and having your respect to have different opinions, you know. And, you know, people, I sat in on many a dinner, and I've sat on a table where a person next door to me is a vegan or a vegetarian, and they don't eat meat. They say, no, I just, you know, you enjoy your meat, you know, no issues whatsoever. I just don't like it, or I just don't want to eat it, or I know, you know, I've got some, you know, I've seen some calves, and I just couldn't eat them now, you know, and that's fine, and that's their choice.
But that's the key word.
And they don't force that choice on you.
It's somebody's choice.
Exactly.
And if you can respect other people's decisions in life, understand where they're coming from, and not, as you say, kind of...
Whether you don't have to agree with it, but try and understand. If you can respect and look at it, yes, okay, I understand why you choose not to eat meat.
Yeah.
And that person then, and I understand why you eat meat, and that's it. They're just different, exactly. And it's the same with this vaccination debate now. Mm. You know, if somebody doesn't want to get vaccinated, that is their choice.
Yeah.
It's you don't have to by law, so you have a and you have to respect that choice for whatever reason whether you agree with it or not. That's their choice, and you have to respect that.
Mm.
But then what they need to respect as well, then, if they bring out the legislation and say, well, look, if you're not double or triple vaccinated, you are not able to go to a sporting event or not able to go to a concert unless you've been vaccinated because we feel it's a danger to other people's safety, then they need to accept the choice that they are putting in place for that reason. So it's all about respecting people's different choices, really, because views do get polarized now, you know, and extremism, I think, is the main culprit of that.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think that's, well, I really, really like the way you said we need to bring people along, because as soon as you alienate somebody because their thinking potentially is backwards or outdated, as soon as you alienate them, how on earth can we expect them to be receptive to a new way of thinking?
Political correctness has done a huge amount of great and important work in bringing inclusiveness, diversity and equality into our everyday lives. Hugely important. But if that political correctness goes to the extreme, then people will dig their heel in the stands and they won't go with that change, without that equality. So, you know, sometimes when, you know, if you can't have a joke and a laugh about something, you know, you've got to sometimes put things in context, understand why it's said, how it's said. And, you know, if something crosses that line, then it needs to be called out. It needs to be dealt with. But, you know, don't call out things because of the political correctness has gone to the extreme. I was in work a few months ago and somebody came into work on a Monday morning, or a friend of mine, a colleague of mine. And there were 7 or 8 of us there. And the discussion went around one of the rugby games that had been the day before. It was one of the Welsh teams had been playing the day before. And they said, oh, did you see the Scarlets play yesterday? They were bloody hopeless. They played like a bunch of puffs. And a couple of people went, oh, you can't say that. And this person, what do you mean I can't say that? I didn't mean nothing by it. And he said to me, Nigel, I didn't mean nothing by that. I said, no, I know you didn't, and I haven't been offended by it, but what you've just said is that anybody who plays sport is not very good if they're gay, if they're a puff.
Yeah.
What do you mean, he said? Well, you're not going to come in here next week and say, oh, the Scarlets played brilliantly yesterday. They played like a bunch of puffs, are you? So you're conveying somebody who is gay in a negative way. He said, do you know what? I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
He said, you're right. He said, I'll never say that again. So it was actually understanding. He didn't mean anything by it, but it was a habit of a way of language being used, which you've been bought. I was brought up in it.
Yeah.
You know, there's languages I would have used as a 20-year-old I would never use today. Mm-hmm. Even though I didn't mean anything nasty by it, you realise, do you know what? I can actually see how that can cause offence. So, you know, it's not a case of, right, you know, that guy's getting sacked for saying that. He's saying, look, hang on now. This is what you said. Can you understand? Do you know what? I do understand how people can be offended with that. I won't be saying that again.
And use it as an opportunity.
Exactly.
I think there's a lot of things, and farmers are guilty of it. We'll use it as a confrontation. You know, if somebody says something, you know, that they're vegan on whatever grounds, farmers can often be quite almost personally offended by it because farming is their way of life, because meat production is their livelihood and literally their life. You immediately, it gets you back up.
Yeah.
But we should use it as an opportunity. Talk it out, be reasonable, respect the opinion and bring them along with you.
And that is the key. But you see, what you can't do then, you can't reason with people who have an extremist view. And that's where extremism then becomes the different dangers, really, and holds back that sort of that respect, you know, that people, you have a choice. And if you have a choice, you need to respect other people's choice, whether you agree with it or not, you know, but you have to respect it.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm sure you're asked all the time, you know, your top three rugby players or, you know, your best people to be, you know, a captain when you're refereeing them. But a bit of a different kind of spin on that question, who would be your top three people in farming at the moment who are doing something different or, you know, helping education or something specific? I mean, top three is probably quite a difficult question, but...
It is a difficult question because I'm hopeless with names. So, you know, I there are people I know on social media, for example.
Yeah.
I follow some things on social media. Mm-hmm. The farmers, is it the Farmers Weekly? No, who's like every week they have a different farmer on running a...
Oh, is it Farmers of the UK?
Farmers of the UK, yeah.
Yeah, and they have someone different on every year.
So that's, you know, I follow that. So you have from an arable side, sheep, from dairy, from beef. So that sort of helps educate people within the agricultural community. I certainly learn a lot from it, but also educating people outside of that as well. So that influences people, I think. I have to say, I wouldn't say that I've never been a big fan of Jeremy Clarkson because I never sort of really watched
Top Gear.
So, you know, but, you know, what he's done with his farming program. So, you know, I wouldn't say I was a fan of Jeremy Clarkson, not a farmer. I didn't really follow him, but... Mm-hmm. You know, I thought he's come across very, very well in his programme and sort of really highlighted, you know, not the only the good and the great things about farming, but the difficulties as well. And that, I think, has made a huge amount of good, I think, in, you know, showcasing to people, you know, what a great way of life it is, but also how a difficult way of life it is and, you know, how important farming is to everybody in the world, because that's whatever food you eat, that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
And so, I think to me, he's done a huge amount of good on that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I'm not going to sort of name any individuals, but, you know, within different organisations, individuals who do a huge amount of work within those different organisations, all the various different organisations, really. In showing the good things about farming, it also highlighting the difficulties as well, and bringing around that change. So, there's a lot of people out there doing a lot of good, and I think that the more that do that, you know, will be the way forward. I think in growing, you know, the farming community and showing how important it is really, and I do get a sense, I think maybe that. we are going back a little bit to the way that things were, which is not a bad thing, you know, of, you know, people wanting to know where their eggs are coming from. People want to know where's the beef coming from, where's the lamb coming from, where the bacon's coming from. People, and I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with big farms where, you know, animals are kept inside, or from a factory point of view, you know, where, particularly in the UK, where animal welfare is really, really high and hugely important as well. So I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with that. But I think people now like to know that, you know, the eggs I'm buying are coming from the chickens who I see out on the field there. So there's a little sense of sort of things maybe that we'll turn him back how it was, really, sort of maybe more local, sustainable, more environmental, friendly, carbon footprint, you know, the travel of something travelling halfway across the world. You know, people now will buy more local and support more local as well, how it used to be years ago. And not there's nothing wrong with your big farms, they have a place as well. But I think there is that sort of trend back maybe to the local family run farms, which I think is a good thing as well, to get that important balance. And obviously knowing a farm as well is not producing, you know, high animal welfare, looking after the animals, you know, the produce is of high quality, knowing where it comes from, but also knowing that they are contributing as well to the fight against climate change as well, and aware of the carbon footprint as well. So, you know, and I think that's what a lot of people now are doing in highlighting that. And I think that's very, very important, particularly for the agricultural community and the farming community moving forward.
Well, thank you so much for that. We're coming to our last question. So, boots and heels, Becca being boots, me being heels. How do you say boots and heels in Welsh?
Well, you're asking, so the boots yw skidie. Heels is, what is heel then?
In
Skidiau is boots skidiau. Or shoes, yeah. Skidiau, what is heels in Welsh? Heels is... Oof, you got me now. You got me.
All the other questions, absolutely far.
Spot on.
Heel is... what is the Welsh for heel?
We've got Nigel stuff.
Wait a minute now. This is where Google comes in very handy.
That's fine.
Heel. Heel in Welsh.
See, this is a good question.
Heel in Welsh. Saudl, that's it, man. I should have got that.
Oh, so how do we say that then?
Saudl. Saudl is heel, yeah. So skid... Boots. Yeah, skidiau.
I hope we won't get any Welsh speakers calling us and saying Nigel Lawrence doesn't know as well.
Skidiau a saudl, yeah. Skidiau a saudl. S&S, skidiau a saudl.
S&S? Maybe that's going to be our saudl. Name now.
I can't believe I forgot.
Man, sounds good, doesn't it? Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It's been an absolute honour to speak to you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Have a little bit of a look around your farm.
Yeah, of course.
So thanks to Nigel for inviting us to his home and for treating us to a proper Welsh cuppa and some chalky biscuits.
As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the episode, and if you've learned anything from it, we'd love to know about it. We're contactable on all socials at Boots and Heels UK.
Thanks again.